You're listening to Out There Atlanta, a podcast featuring interviews with artists in Atlanta and beyond, conducted in the spirit of a casual conversation. Out There Atlanta is sponsored by burnaway.org, an online destination for dialogue about the arts. Music for this podcast was provided by MSIF. This interview is part of Out There Atlanta Summer Sound Series, a collection of interviews with artists who find inspiration in sound or directly use it in their works. For this podcast, I interviewed Michael Gibson, an Atlanta-based artist who works with painting, drawing, and sound. For this podcast, we discussed two of his sound pieces. We Are Selling Mainly to Americans, which is the first sound piece that he did and was recorded in December 2007 at an art fair. And the second is YNWA, a site-specific sound installation created for the second Athens Biennale. Here's Michael.
I'm Michael Gibson. I'm an artist living here in Atlanta and New York. I've been working in pretty much all media for the last 15 plus years. I think the first time that I ever really started to play around with the idea of how sound could create like an environment or be a surrogate for images was when I was working with really abstract films in the 80s. Mm-hmm. I was introduced to Stan Brakhage and was very much influenced by what he had been doing and was doing with images and you know, trying my own sort of experimentation with nonlinear sort of abstract images moving, and felt like I needed to create a sort of another dimension. And so I started composing these not really musical scores, but just environmental experiential sort of moments. Mm-hmm. That sort of shored up and maybe somehow led to a reading.
Visually, what was going on in the films, and what sort of sounds were you pulling from to complement that?
The sounds I was using then were a lot of really kind of mistakes, because I played around with instruments that I didn't really know how to play, and I would just...
Do you call them mistakes now, or was this back when you were doing work like this, you were like purposefully seeking these mistakes and sort of erroneous sounds?
I think I was just searching for sounds that I could somehow connect with. Mm-hmm. And not knowing sort of how to find them, I would find them by accident. And so I guess I would, you know, then I would have thought of them as mistakes. But now they're more of sort of part of the language that I tend to use as I've moved forward. I was aware of Stephen Reich and sort of the work that he had done with tape, and very much influenced by that, especially sort of the artifacts that happened, you know, when early analog recordings would start to degrade. Well, what he would do is he would take recordings, and he would take tape recordings especially, and he would make duplicates and then set recorders up, and these recorders would move at fractions. He would calibrate them so that one recorder would move at a different rate than the one adjacent to it. Mm-hmm. And so recordings would start out sounding complementary, as if it was in a full room, but then go out of phase. And when it would go out of phase, it would start to echo. And then the echo would degrade to noise. And then as they started to sync back up again, it would then loop back to this sort of harmonious. So what started out sounding like stereo, would start to fight itself as it was backwards, and then find
some resolution in the end.
The resolution in the end.
Huh. Yeah. Interesting.
So I knew about that work. I knew about the early work of Stephen Reich and what he was doing with found recordings and manipulating devices to create sort of ambient effects and environments. And so I think that probably was one of the first things that, you know, sort of influenced the way that I found, you know, musical notes or whatever. Mm-hmm. For these early films.
And you were explicitly working with musical instruments, or was it sort of a variety of...
I think I probably also had some, you know, small handheld tape recorders that...
I hope like the ones in Home Alone. Or maybe this is a little too early for that. When did that movie come out? You know, I'm talking about the little handheld thing.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, it was around, you know, probably around that time. Yeah, so I've always liked the sort of the warmth of tape and early sort of, you know, less digital or more analog sort of devices.
Has it been a more recent foray back into sound for you, or has it been a continuous thing?
No, there was a break. I moved away from the film and started doing more in the studio with drawing and painting. And so that really became the focus for a number of years. And it really wasn't until probably 2002 or three that I moved back into working with sound. And it was a little bit by accident. I was at an art fair, and you know, the trajectory of the art world and especially the fairs and everything had caused a lot of talk around, you know, what is this thing that happens, this transient city that pops up and things happen, and how that was stealing the power from, you know, dealers in New York and dealers in LA. And so people were talking about, like, how do we comment on this? And artists were feeling, some were feeling like they were sort of, you know, being commoditized beyond, you know, the normal.
Oh, just wait, a couple of years later.
Yeah,
this
sure.
was back in 2003, they didn't know anything yet.
Yeah, so you know, there was this whole conversation about, like, what is the influence of the art fair? And
do you remember which fair this was?
Well, I can remember. I was part of the first Art Basel fair in Miami, and that was in 2001. But that was canceled because of 9/11. Mm. So fast forward happened in a hotel. So I was part of that fair. So this was a couple of years later. The conversation had been happening pretty much every time I was at an art fair. Someone would start to talk about, like, you know, what is this thing? Why is it out of control? You know, and, you know, what do you do with it? And for me, for the most part, I wasn't really interested in commenting on art fairs. I thought that there was, you know, a lot of other things that were much more, you know, interesting. And the business of art is the business of art. And it's not really, you know, an artist's business to be a part of that unless your work is about that. And so I really wasn't that interested in commenting on it. But I happened to be at the Armory a couple of years later, maybe a year or two. After that, and I was waiting for one of the curators from MoMA to show me drawings that he had purchased, and so I was standing, and I was standing by the area where they sell coffee. They're sort of at the side, you know, with a barista, and I'd been at the fair for about 3 hours, and I was completely exhausted and tired, and I couldn't look at any art anymore. I was just like, you know, I was completely visually exhausted. And so I was staring at the floor, and I was actually looking at the ceiling, I mean the floor tiles, and thinking about sort of, you know, what pattern and why it's in this pattern. You know, so it was just like I was completely out of the context of the fair, looking at something else. And I started noticing what was being said around me. And it was a few art dealers who were buying, you know, something to drink and some, you know, having a break from their booths, and they were talking about the business. And I thought, this is really more interesting than anything else that's going on, because that is it, right? It's everyone trying to influence the market, trying to, you know, either sell something to someone or steer someone away from something that they're thinking of purchasing. It was a lot of influencers, and so I thought, this is it. So I immediately, I had a look at the drawings with Christian Rottermeier, and then immediately excused myself, and I went over to B&H, the electronics store, and I bought a Zoom recorder and a couple of lav mics and a shotgun mic, and I came back to the fair, and I started recording all that was happening. And from time to time, I would step outside and listen, and I would return the equipment, buy new equipment. And over the course of the day, I had dialed in my kit, and I was ready to go. And so when the next Art Basel fair happened, I showed up ready to go, and I had targeted 7 art dealers. And
like
for 7 days, I followed people around and recorded what they were saying as they were selling art.
Well, for all the tech heads out there, what was that final kit that you had decided on? And was it visible? Did these people know?
No, it was completely invisible. I don't remember the brand of the mics, unfortunately, but I had a couple of of lapel mics, and one that I could actually hide in the sleeve of my sweater, and another that I could actually put through the weave of the shoulder of my sweater. And then I had a really great focusable shotgun mic that I could slip into my sleeve and hold a cup of coffee so I could actually stand near someone and holding my coffee and point it toward them and listen to what they were saying.
No one's ever going to want to stand next to you again at a party.
I actually have. There's a collector in New York who has never had a conversation around me since.
Oh.
He'll actually hold me in front of him.
And so you can talk behind.
Yeah, talk behind me.
Surreptitiously.
Yeah.
Was there any danger of someone like clapping their hand on your shoulder and squashing the mic?
I mean, sure. And there are great things that happened. There are great things that happened the way that the different mics would, they were all feeding into one device, how they would pick up sounds differently.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were lots of really beautiful artifacts that maybe we're not, you know, describing a conversation, but we're actually adding to the overall sort of experience of the space. You can really sort of feel, you know, the energy.
Wow. So you recorded 7 dealers over the course of how many days?
7 days. What I did was I actually started out on the steps outside the fair before it opened. And there were a whole group of people talking about, you know, tech startups and who just made a lot of money, who they were, you know, and
targeting
who they were going to sell, you know, work to. And the fair started. I walked inside and started just really just walking around and listening. I was wearing a one ear piece, and so I could hear sort of what I was picking up, and sometimes I would actually hear things on the device before I would hear it, you know, because it was so sensitive.
Oh, weird.
And so I would start to follow conversations. And, what ended up happening was a piece that's, I decided to, you know, so how do you create a limitation for something? And I thought, you know, it shouldn't be longer than a rock ballad. So I made this piece that was 3 minutes and 11 seconds. And it was 7 days.
This is not
days.
Like someone's crazy guitar solo or drum solo that goes on for 30 minutes.
Right. So I created this piece called "We're Selling Mainly to Americans," which is a quote from Jeffrey Deitch, a quote that I captured on the last day of the fair. Someone walked into his booth and said, you know, how's the fair going? And he launched into this explanation of what had been going on. And so I created sort of a condensed version of the 7 days into 3 minutes and 11 seconds, and that became "We're Selling Mainly to Americans."
Here's a clip of "We're Selling Mainly to Americans."
I then created an edition of iPod Nanos, because this whole thing was really about, you know, the commodity and the object, and so I wanted to actually like take this experience and put it into an object. And so what I actually did was, you know, I took an iPod Nano and I rebranded it as "We're Selling Mainly to Americans." So we removed all of the Apple logo, and we created a logo for "We're Selling Mainly to Americans," and it became the object, you know, the sort of commodity of the experience of the fair.
Did you sell any of it back to those 7 dealers?
Yes.
Was this to keep their words out of the public eye, or was
no? It was it was because they actually learned of the piece, and it was interesting. I mean, you know, there are people who love and hate art fairs, but ultimately it's an experience where without the dealers, there's a vast community out there who wouldn't be educated. And so they're influencing and they're trying to, you know, push people in a direction or pull and to create value. I could have easily taken a much more sort of cynical track and edited something that would have been just the sort of the worst of the fear. But instead, I tried to keep it sort of like, you know, what actually was the sort of, you know, what was the level? And it's interesting because I think you get this, you get the sense of what that was like. What was the, you know, the height of the art market at the height of the power of the fair? And little did I know, you know, just months later, everything would crash.
Yeah. Crash. So how did you, I'm stunned that you edited down 7 days of material into 3 minutes. I mean, I record for like 45 minutes with these podcasts, and carving it down to 30 minutes is kind of tough sometimes, and it's very tedious. So I'm interested to know, like, what sort of decisions you were making, like what sort of sounds you were drawn to, or sound bites or quotes, and what that collage of sound ended up being like in the end.
Well, I think my process was to sort of take the entire library of what I've created or captured, and then just start pulling down, you know, and creating sort of a hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And then it's a lot of intuition. You know, I would, once I'd created sort of the first level of these are the you know, the peaks of what happened over 7 days, you know, I would just sort of go through and mentally, you know, create some sort of index of what I have. And then I usually just start working, and it's intuition. I'm like, you know, I need this next, and then that goes here, and then this goes here, and then, you know, I just keep, you know, bringing it down. And I also had the luxury of not, you know, adhering to a narrative, which is different than what you're doing, where you're actually trying to, you know, create a story that has some sort of sense of flow. But it's, you know, in, you know, working with abstract sound bites, you have a little bit more leeway. But it's mostly just, you know, just the hardest thing is listening to everything and sort of keeping it straight in your head, because, you know, I'm not one of those artists who creates, you know, 1,000 post-it notes and then assembles it visually and then goes back in, and then it's just a matter of, you know, editing to put it together.
It's, you know, with that many days of, I imagine even if you transcribed it, it would still be sort of an insurmountable task to try to remember where certain things were happening over that much time.
Yeah, and speaking of transcribing, one of the things that I did after the piece was created was that I would give it to friends, and they would actually transcribe what they heard.
Oh, from the 3 minutes and 30 seconds?
Yes, because it's you know, it was just an interesting exercise. Adrienne Williams did it when we were in Greece. I gave her, we're selling mainly to Americans, and she quickly transcribed it. And it's interesting what you hear. You know, it's almost like the game you played as a kid where...
Oh, yeah,
you know,
telephone.
Yeah, telephone, exactly.
Huh. What was the... And so it seems like overall the dealer reaction from those specific people was favorable. Oh, did you say where you ended up exhibiting this piece?
Well, this piece, it was installed in Atlanta at the Contemporary. I'm not sure exactly, you know, what the dates were, but it was up in the Contemporary sort of in two different ways. I because it was captured sort of as an ambient, sort of moving experience, I never really wanted it to be installed in a cul-de-sac, in a gallery. I wanted it to be in sort of a space that a person would move through, because the activity of actually capturing the sound was one of motion. Like, I was constantly moving through the fair. I was constantly, you know, sort of seeking out the next experience. And so it was installed at the Contemporary as an ambient space. There's a circular gallery that actually sort of functions as a speaker, where if you align the equipment properly, that actually starts to act like a megaphone. So it was installed there, and then it later was part of a show that opened in Sweden called Art Is Not Mute, which was an entire exhibition or listening experience of audio works. And through its sort of inclusion in Art Is Not Mute, it became a part of a traveling show that moved throughout Europe. And it was a result of that that I was then commissioned to do the Greek Biennial. The overarching theme for the Athens Biennial in 2009 was heaven. And within that program, there were several sub-programs, one of which was curated by Kay Sophie Rabinowitz. And Kay had chosen a German text about designing and implementing garden colonies as the thesis for her exhibition. And so we had a meeting, and she said that she wanted to include a sound work by me, and I didn't really understand exactly the full text of Splendid Isolation, which was what she was drawing from. So I had her sort of like, you know, read it to me in translation. And in doing that, it seemed like what it was the idea of taking of a planned community and then translating it throughout the countryside in Germany. When I first started thinking about the piece, I thought about there were three elements that were really interesting to me. One was the idea of planning a community and having sort of this agenda. And so that I thought was really kind of an interesting idea with respect to, like, you know, not letting a community happen naturally, but actually creating a series of steps in order to make it happen. Mm-hmm. That was interesting. And then the second thing that I thought was really interesting about, like, planning a community and this concept of a garden community was the idea of a matrix and how you would populate that matrix or template. And then the third thing would be, you know, sort of a byproduct of all that, which was how would it function day to day with respect to public and private space. And so I think that that's sometimes a trap with the idea of, like, you know, having a plan for a community versus letting one happen naturally. And so my piece sort of started to come together around those three points, and immediately I started being drawn to particular things that I knew of in terms of existing sounds or existing sort of cultural samples that I could use versus actually going out and creating something or capturing something on my own. And so that in itself became really interesting to me, because I like the idea that I would actually pull from sort of a continuum of media to create the work. And so with respect to the idea of having a plan, I immediately thought of Duchamp's The White Box, and a recording from, I believe it was 1911, of Duchamp reading the sort of instructions for making art. And then the second part of it was like the idea of having this template or matrix, and then how would you populate it? And I started thinking about how does that naturally happen or unnaturally happen. And one of the ways that I think that people find themselves in real estate adjacent to others that they may not have planned on, they may have not have had any sort of idea for how they might end up next to someone. One of the ways that happens is in sports stadiums. I just started thinking about, you know, the idea of, like, you know, you buy a ticket, you end up on a piece of real estate, and you are with a group of people who you immediately become a community based on your proximity to one another, and then also the idea of you have a common goal, which is your team, right? So I started thinking about Liverpool soccer fans, because I grew up playing soccer and watching soccer on television, and the Liverpool fans have this song that they sing, and when they sing the song, they all come together, and they rise up, and it's very beautiful, and it actually is really kind of moving, and it immediately, you know, creates this sort of unity in an artificial community, or an artificial gathering of a community. And and then the third thing that I thought was interesting with respect to the idea of public versus private space, and also the idea of translation, was sort of thinking about Francis Ford Coppola's film The Conversation, and how a couple trying to have a private conversation in a public space actually are being recorded and captured. The theme of the movie is actually the idea that, you know, the public space is not
not private, and there's no real private space. And so I took these samples and I started to put them together in a way that that wouldn't create a narrative, but would sort of trigger an emotional response to a space. And so the way I conceived it was that it would be in a public space, and it would run in a loop for 6 hours. It was 10 minutes long, but it had sort of this seamlessness about it that would flow. And it would sort of move between this idea of a private conversation being captured, a community rising up, and sort of an underlying, buried, almost subliminal message of the plan for building or creating.
Why for 6 hours?
Because it was the sort of the life of the space. It was installed in a public space that was just outside. It was sort of the transition point from one venue to the next of the biennial, and it was a space that was used for people would come there and ride their bikes, and others would play soccer, and it was this sort of large, beautiful piazza of sorts and that was sort of the life cycle of that space over the course of a day. It was about like a 6 hour period where people would show up and interact with the space, meet with their friends, and then disperse back out as the sun went down. So it was a way to sort of create a layer of experience for the people moving through the space.
Here's a clip of YNWA. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. If you'd like to know more about Michael's work, head to www.michaelgibsonstudio.com. As always, check out burnaway.org for events, reviews, and articles about art. And check out our website, outthereatlanta.com, for photos and updates. Thanks for listening.